Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am playing an interview with the soon-to-be 89-year-old David Shepherd, who the internet identifies as the father of improvisational theater, because he was one of the founders of the very first improvisational theater troupe in the United States, which was called Compass, and which morphed into Second City, which gave us, if you don't already know about Second City, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, Ed Asner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You'll hear David talk all about them. David is a person who has followed the impulses of his life wherever they led him. And to hear him look back over this life and to still be looking forward is extraordinary. This is an amazing story. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about recognizing that the person you think you are, the person you tell everybody else that you are, the person that you demonstrate to the rest of the world, may not be all there is to you. You may be more than you think you are. You may be more than you are telling the rest of us you are. You may be more than other people are telling you you are. How can this be, and what difference can it possibly make? Maybe you're thinking that. Probably you're not thinking that. Probably if you were thinking, how can this be, and what difference does it make, you're already gone. Because you probably... Wow, that is so interesting. In any case, if you're still here and you're curious about how this can be And what difference it makes, let me tell you what I believe. This is what I believe. This is the gospel according to Lynn. It's not written in some book somewhere by an authority who pretends to know everything. I don't pretend to know everything. I pretend to know what I believe. And so when you listen to me, what you're getting is what I believe. Now, having said that, I am a psychotherapist. I am trained, I am licensed in California and Florida. And I have been in private practice since 1982. I don't even want to guess at how many years that is. And my beliefs are based in large part on the experience of my private practice, what I have heard people say, what I have helped people to struggle with, to deal with, to heal, to solve. Now, admittedly, it's not a huge sample. The people who come into psychotherapy are people who are aware that something is not right, that they are somehow out of sync. However, I do think that the people who come into therapy are representative of the population, except that so many of us are not aware that we're out of sync. So many of us have created defenses that are so strong that we are rarely at the mercy of the feelings that would tell us that something is wrong. And of course, we live in this society that seems to be dedicated to distracting us from ourselves. I don't have to tell you. Internet, TV, cell phones, texting, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, movies, DVDs, CDs, music everywhere. So we are not encouraged to have quiet time and to reflect on whether we feel okay about who we are. But we are still able to interact, however, in a more limited way than we used to. We do still have families, friends, colleagues, and some people have teachers, some people have employers or employees. And within those interactions, we can quite often recognize a pattern in which we are not happy or comfortable or satisfied. We can quite often experience the recurring pattern of this didn't go the way I would have wanted it to go. You know, everybody knows that second marriages quite often don't last any longer than first marriages, and people are on to their third marriage before they actually figure out that they're marrying the same kind of person and they're running into the same kind of problem, and the person that they're married is saying the same thing about them that the other two people said about them. Only the first time they were sure it was the other person and that person was crazy, and the second time, I don't know what we did with that, but now by the third time, sometimes I treat a lot of couples, and I like to say that I prefer to treat couples who are on their second or third marriage, because by that time they are actually more likely to be willing that to see that they are somehow contributing. What is it that they are or aren't doing? And this sometimes is the only way that people actually discover parts of themselves for which they had been in denial, parts of themselves that they did not know were there. I quite often treat couples where the people, this always happens, of course, both people are saying, well, if only he, if only she, why didn't you, and why won't you? And they are almost never spontaneously looking at how they contributed. And when they do, they inevitably discover something about themselves that they did not really know was there. Some need that they hadn't satisfied, some reflex behavior that they thought was, well, this is just the way I am. Inevitably, it is not just the way they are. it is the way their childhood, their family of origin, their culture, their religion, their school, their teacher, their sibling, somebody who was powerful enough to tell them to suppress that, told them to suppress it. And so they came into adulthood not knowing that they could say, no, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. Or saying, I want that. I want that. You'd be amazed how often I have to give the exercise. Just repeat after me, I want. And how difficult that is for so many people. I tell this story a lot about the client who came to me who was just, she couldn't stand up for herself in any way, and she got taken advantage of at work and by her friends and by her husband and by her children and everybody. And as we did the work, we discovered this moment in her life still there. She's 3 or 4 years old, and her mommy takes her to a birthday party of another little 3 or 4 year old. And at this particular party, the mother has a lot of presents for everybody. And they're all out in the middle of the room, and everybody gets a number, and you get to choose the present based on your number. And this little girl gets number one. And she runs up and picks this huge present, and her mother shrieks at her, "Not that!" And the little girl drops it. And her mother tells you, "It's not nice to pick the biggest present." Her cheeks still burn with the shame of that. Her certainty that she must not do what she wants. She must not reach for what she yearns for. Well, I've made this point, I know. I make it and make it and make it. Generally, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art so that you can hear what it sounds like when somebody is really being congruent. Today's interview is really, really special. I did this interview a year ago, and at that time, the interviewee, David Shepherd, had just celebrated his 88th birthday. You'll hear him talk about it. And on October 10th of this year, he's going to be 89. And I am running this interview as a celebration of David Shepherd, who, as you will hear me say over and again in this interview, the internet identifies David as the father of improvisational theater. David insists over and over that he was actually the uncle, and he will tell you why. But David, along with Paul Sills, is the creator of Compass, which morphed into Second City. And I don't have to tell you probably how significant Second City was, how many famous people came out of it. So here is David's story, which was something of a surprise to me. And as you will hear in this interview, I was lucky enough to work with David many, many years ago in one of his formats for improvisation. But I didn't know anything about him before and after the time I spent in his troupe. And so this is all new stuff for me too, and it's wonderful, wonderful to hear this man talk about his life. There is no guile in David Shepherd. What you hear is what there is, and so I'm not going to say another word except here is David Shepherd. Okay, so I am here with David Shepherd, who is the father of improvisational theater. You know,
no, not the father, the uncle.
Well, but you know they're calling you the father.
Oh, yes, that's because I'm almost dead.
I see. But you mean you're the uncle because it was you and Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I want you to know that all over the internet they are calling you the father of improvisational theater.
Yeah. Now, I explained to you why.
Because you're almost dead.
Yes.
That's right. How old are you, David?
Eight.
You're 88?
Yeah.
I thought you were 87.
No, you're wrong.
Another year snuck up on me. When's your birthday?
October 10.
October 10. So you were just 88.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, you don't look almost dead to me. I was explaining to David that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Well, I don't make any living.
No, but you made your life
yes, with the art of improvisation.
And I'm writing a book about it now. I'm writing a book about some 12 formats that I've been involved in, beginning with Compass, which hired Shelley Berman and Mike Nichols, Elaine May, later on Alan Arkin, Jerry Stiller. It was a famous piece. Strange, because that was the first one I did. It's the most well-known.
Because of
the people.
Oh, of course. Yeah. But the first one you did was Compass. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And all of those famous people and more, I know, came out of that experience.
Yeah.
A question that I like to ask people is, this is a long way for you to answer, but you made your life with the art of improvisation. How old were you when you started Compass?
I was in my early 30s, I guess.
Okay. So you were not really young even then. I mean, 30 is not that young. So did you always have an interest in theater or in stories or in acting or in...
No, it just came spontaneously. I was in India teaching in...
What were you teaching?
Teaching English.
In India?
In India.
How did that happen?
Well, I wanted to go to the Orient, find out what it was all about. Could have gone to Burma, could have gone to China. I went to India instead.
India in the 50s?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
early
would have been.
50s.
Right.
And I got a job. I applied to the Protestants. They said I was not devout enough.
How did they know?
Oh, just by interviewing me, I guess. Uh-huh. And I never really believed in God, so it became apparent that I was not for the Protestants. But the Catholics accepted me wholeheartedly, and I went to teach at their college in Bombay.
I'm just curious, had you studied to be a teacher?
No, not really.
Did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
The idea that I had, yeah, let's be a teacher, okay? What do you do with all this stuff? Oh, teach. And they gave me 7 classes with 150 students in each class.
Little Indian kids?
Yeah.
And you were supposed to teach them English?
Well, I taught them Thackeray.
You taught them what?
Thackeray.
Thackeray?
That's a famous...
Author, novelist.
Author, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You taught them Thackeray?
Yeah.
Did they like it?
I don't know. But they stayed there until they had their examinations, and most of them passed.
Wow. So they could read Thackeray?
So they could discuss Thackeray on an exam question. And most of my friends were Parsis, which is a different sect.
Yes. In India, you mean?
In India, right.
Did they speak English?
Yes. They spoke it fluently. They spoke it better than I did. And
did you like India?
Yeah, I was there for 18 months, I think, in the provinces and then in Bombay. And at the end of that time, I got the impulse, let's revolutionize the theater, okay?
Okay.
All right, that meant going back to New York, where I had a friend, Jim Kearns, who met me at the boat. And I did a really stupid attempt at improvisational theater, which was called The Rolling Stage, with Epstein, a guy who's now famous. And that failed. So I immediately went to Chicago with a truck. And when I got there, I met some people who were also interested in theater. We did a rep theater called Playwrights Theater Club. That lasted 2 years. And Paul Sills was the director. He's the son of Viola Spolin, as you probably know. And I was his lieutenant, more or less. I didn't know anything about what I was doing, but I was the producer because I was funneling some of my money to this organization. And
so let me see if I get this right. You had some money, and you had an interest in revolutionizing the theater.
Yeah.
And Paul had these games from his mother, Viola Smolin.
Right.
And so this was sort of...
We had about 40 people on staff in Chicago.
Is this still from Playwrights Horizons?
Playwrights Theater Club.
From Playwrights Theater Club?
Mm-hmm.
And so then you morphed it into Compass, or you...
Yeah, after that closed, which it was bound to do because we were really not business people. They have a lot of repertory theater now in Chicago run by business people with their heads screwed on. It closed, and I immediately went to Hyde Park. I said, I'm going to do cabaret theater, which I don't think had been done up to that point. Yeah.
They say that Compass was the first improvisational theater in the United States.
I believe them. So we found a storefront, and Paul and I and Andy Duncan went in and created a stage in it. I can't remember how many people were seated there. It was 80 or 120. And I had a friend named Mickey LeClaire who sat at the entrance and took people's money. I think it was $2 to get in. But Mickey was also a champion chess player. So when we were not on stage, we were sitting next to the window on 55th Street, or 53rd Street, or whatever it was. And we were sitting there playing chess all day long. I was because I was the producer, I was the worst chess player. And Barbara Harris used to beat me all the time. So that went on until we got other people to come, Mike Nichols, Shelley Berman, and the thing popped, became very successful. We did Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to St. Louis.
Oh.
And Alan Arkin and Shelley Berman were in St. Louis. No, Jerry Stiller, excuse me, I'm getting it mixed up. Jerry Stiller. And they didn't get along. But we did it at the Crystal Palace, which was run by the Lannisman family. And it worked. And we did group after group after group. I just shuttled people out to St. Louis. I got tired of directing. I got other people to direct. And I drank a lot of gin. My main thing was to get into the theater on the seventh row and drink a lot of gin. And so it went.
Did it help?
Well, yeah, it made it easy to be there.
Was it difficult to be there?
No. Lannisman made it very simple. They were a very complex and wonderful family. So it was interesting to be in St. Louis. And then after that, we had a company in Boston, had a company in New York, had a company in the Catskills. It just went on and on. The last company that I directed was in Hyannisport when Kennedy was alive. And Alan Alda used to do a terrific impersonation of Kennedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my wife was in that company, Suzanne Shepherd, and it worked, but it was short-lived. and went to Washington, I did not go with it. But that was the end of it, and now I'm trying to get people who were in it to write about what
it was
made
like.
It work and mm-hmm. what could how it could have worked better.
Who are you talking to about writing pieces of it?
Well, I can't tell you because I didn't do it yet, but I'm going to ask Alan Arkin, who called me up last week, to write a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he has very bad memories.
Bad memories meaning the unpleasant memories?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I'm going to ask Jerry Stiller to write a piece. And I'm going to ask Alan Alda to write a piece. I will also ask Barbara Harris, but I don't think she will write a piece. I don't think she's up for it. So anyway, I have that in mind. See, at the one hand, I'm dying, falling apart rapidly. On the other hand, I'm writing two books. So the two books are about the formats that I've lived through.
The format, the improvisational formats? Now, this is interesting to me because I didn't say, but I'm an alumni of one of those formats. The format that you were calling either responsive scene or community makers. And that was...
Well, community makers is a business.
Oh, it is?
Yes, it's a pretend business. And I've never made any money, but I mean, that was our guise.
Well, it's my memory of what we did was that we played college campuses and we played a prison. The prison was extraordinary because we got all the inmates up to work.
Yes, I remember that.
Wow, it was so powerful. And they were, the inmates were playing the guards.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary. They were amazing. And that was part of that format, that the audience was encouraged to get up and work.
Yeah.
But also, if they didn't actually get up and work, they yelled out directions to us. So they would say, you know, change roles or, you know, do it in pantomime or, you know, all kinds of, we kept getting directions thrown at us from the audience.
Yeah, and sometimes they'd say, be in an Oldsmobile, and then we get in the Oldsmobile and crank up the windows, and they say, that's wrong!
Yeah,
it's
right.
Not that side!
That's
it's
right.
The other side!
That's right. But they were involved.
Yeah.
I mean, they were definitely involved. So that's the format that I was in, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't know any of the other formats because, because that was my experience with you.
You'll have to read the book.
I'll have to read the book. Are you, when you say you've written, I'm just curious, are you typing? Are you dictating? What are you doing?
I do everything, and I send it to a woman who's blind. Her name is Deirdre Muccio, and she's a fabulous editor, and she turns it into a book.
Well.
I'm writing a book of journals that Deirdre Muccio is finishing.
Mm-hmm.
But she can't finish it because I keep writing as I live. She can only finish it when I'm dead, but I'm not dead yet.
No, you clearly are not.
Thank you. The other book I'm writing, I have to finish the chapter about the novel, and that's giving me a hard time.
What about the novel?
Well, we never did a successful improvisational novel.
Oh, that was one of the formats?
Yeah, one of the ones we tried it in Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried it here in the Valley. And
we're in Belcherstown, Massachusetts. Is that what you mean, here in the Valley?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Valley extends from almost Boston all over to the almost all the way to the Hudson.
So you tried it here somewhere?
Yeah. Didn't work.
What went wrong?
Well, I don't know. I'm investigating that.
Well, but
right
when you
now,
say
and I have friends to help me to do that.
Well, wait. When you say it didn't work, can you tell me what that means?
It didn't end up with a product.
Oh, you didn't wind up with a novel?
No.
What did you get?
I got a mess.
I bet you didn't like that.
No. And
was it the?
I involved a lot of people in making this mess. And usually my messes come out, but this one didn't come out.
So, do you think that this was the fault of the format, or you think that people?
It didn't have the right format.
Yeah, right. So it was a faulty format.
It was a faulty format. We had a lousy idea to develop.
Whose idea was it?
I can't remember.
Okay, well, we won't give them credit for it then.
No.
So I have a question now.
Yes.
So in the early 50s, you and Paul create Compass, and then you send it off in various companies all over the country.
Right.
And then at some point, you decide you don't want to do that anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, all these companies collapsed.
Ah.
And I went on to do different things.
Okay, so you went on. So do you remember the first thing you went on to do after that?
Well, I think it was Responsive Scene.
So then it would have been the thing I was in.
Yeah.
Right.
You
so
were there.
I was there. So is that like in the late 60s or do
early,
you remember?
Early 60s,
early
I think.
Right.
Responsive Scene.
Right. And I can't remember what happened to that. Do you? How it ended?
No.
Do you remember what you did after that? Because that was in New York City and here you are in Massachusetts.
Yeah. Well, this is a sexual move. I moved from my second wife here for sexual reasons.
Because there was a woman here that you were interested in?
Yeah, her name is Nancy Fletcher.
Oh, and you're still with her?
Yes, this is her house.
Ah!
So it seems to be that sex drives me from city to city. And I'm not boasting, I'm just saying that's the way it works.
I didn't hear it as a boast.
Oh.
I mean, I just heard it as a statement of fact.
Thank you. All right, so we did Responsive Scene.
So when did, so.
And that went on the radio.
Yes.
Radio station.
Yes, we had improvisational radio.
Right.
Yeah, and Howard Jerome, who was then Jerome Jerome, as I remember it.
Yes.
And he introduced Naked Radio.
Right.
Yes. Oh, I remember that. People would call in, and they would start these improvs out of nothing, and we would respond.
Yeah, and it was incredible. We only had one bad call. The man was so stoned or drunk,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, we couldn't even handle it.
Right.
But most of the calls were taken by a man named Michael Golding. And we had a guy sitting on the telephone,
mm-hmm.
WRVR, who would take these calls beginning maybe 15 minutes before the show began. So we'd have like lots of suggestions even before the show. And then I think we went on for about an hour. You're bringing back all the memories. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
So we did that.
Okay, so what came after that then?
Then we did the Improv Olympics, I think, which was a competition. And we had...
Where was that?
A dozen more in Chicago at Second City, which gave us permission to use their stage on, I think it was Monday night. And I had a partner named Sharna Halpern, who is now running I.O. in Chicago and L.A.
Hmm.
And She's a very feisty woman. So we were all over Chicago until Second City gave us permission to perform there on Monday nights. And we had over a dozen teams. There were teams of rabbis.
Of rabbis?
Rabbis. We had a team of cops. We had a team of psychiatrists.
My goodness.
Which was the most difficult team. And I don't have a list of the teams, but they exist. I don't think they're doing that anymore.
Were there, was any of this recorded? You know, I mean, they certainly had audio. They might not have had video, or, well, they had film. Did any of this exist on, you know, does any of it still exist? Do you know?
I don't know, but when we finish, I'll get up and look at my library.
Okay.
So, that went on. And,
did you like it?
Yeah. It seemed to make sense to me. These teams were based on professions.
Yeah, that's fascinating. How did you find, how many rabbis, how many cops, how many psychiatrists?
Well, I think there were six rabbis, one a woman, and there were about 10 cops, I think.
Where did you find 10 cops that were willing to...
Well, it just happened.
Wow, that's amazing.
And other cities found out about it, and they liked it. And so it grew in reputation. And I don't think it exists today, but... The original format Compass exists today in about 1,000 cities.
Really?
Yeah. It's hard to keep up with. Now, if I was a proper businessman, I would be in touch with all of them.
Yeah.
And I'd be...
Collecting royalties.
Collecting royalties and noodling them and whatnot. But I'm not a proper businessman.
No, revolutionaries rarely are.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. How do you feel about the fact that you created something that's epidemic?
Oh, I feel good.
Yeah.
That gives me a reason for existing.
Yes.
And I feel a lot of these formats were never completed. Like we'd say, oh, let's do improvisation on the blank stage. And we do that for 3 months. And meanwhile, we're doing something else. It slips from one format to another. And,
You know, I'm sorry, but I think it's really a valuable idea for you to put down the different formats.
Uh-huh.
I don't think people really, even people who are doing improvisation today, actually understand that there are different formats that they can use.
Yeah, well, if I finish the book, then they can understand.
I agree. I think it'd be really valuable.
Right. Now, let's segue to the last format.
Okay.
Which is called Life Play.
When did you create that?
It's about 4 or 5 years ago. I created it with two men, Carmen DeWeese and Chris Britt. One of them was mostly in Boston and the other one was mostly on the West Coast. And I was here in the Valley. Now, don't ask me how we got it together, but they were both of them magicians. And they were looking for magic through improvisation. We found it in Life Play, which had many different names. And we figured that this thing would work on the phone, and it did. I mean, we do it on the porch, or... I'm going to ignore that phone.
Okay, so the phone is going to ring, and David's going to ignore it.
This is fun.
Oh, I'm glad.
I enjoy this.
I'm very glad. Because you provided a lot of fun for me.
Oh, good.
When I auditioned for you, I didn't have any acting training or anything.
Mm.
But you chose me for that group.
Mm.
It meant a lot to me.
That was smart.
Thank you. I thought I was lucky, is what I thought. So, okay, so you and these two magicians created Life Play, which is on the telephone.
Well, we play as a group. I'm getting back in touch.
He's touching me. Okay, so this is the current format, which you are still doing. And by the way, I haven't asked, do people pay for this when they call in?
No, but we will be charging when we expand, the dollar a shot or whatever.
Okay, so this is the creation. One would be in on the creation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And so Howard is in Toronto.
Yeah.
And
Michael Golding is very much in it.
And where is he?
L.A.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to have this guy over my shoulder, so far away.
How did you find him, or how did he find you?
Well, when we first did Responsive Scene, I guess it was, he came on with Bob Aberdeen. I was then 14 years old.
14 years? Is that what you're saying?
14 years old.
Who was 14?
Michael.
Oh, my goodness.
And he created a team with all his high school buddies. And there they were playing underneath the window where I was living in Washington Square Village with my wife, Connie. And I'd look out the window, and there they were playing my games down on the street. So that was compelling.
Wow.
And it just got closer and closer. It'd come to my country house, and we'd cook and play, and they'd ruin my car by driving it in places where it shouldn't go, and then we'd play some more.
Oh, I'm sorry I missed that.
Yeah.
But that was fun.
You would have found it fun.
Mm-hmm. So Michael and Chris and you developed Life Play, essentially. And then Howard came in and expanded it.
Yeah.
And so right now, is it mostly Michael and Howard and you playing?
Yeah, and some other people. The thing is very fragile now, but it's getting stronger fast. Now, why I'm doing this, I have no idea.
You mean why you're doing Life Play?
Why I'm doing anything.
Any of it, yeah.
I have no idea.
Well,
why I'm doing it, but it seems that I am hooked to a chair next to a desk where there are papers and a phone.
I think you're hooked to production.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean that you simply don't stop producing. So it doesn't really matter, I mean, how old you are or whether you're falling apart, because you just keep having ideas.
Right. That seems to be the way it's going. Now, I don't have any ideas for the future except to write a book called Almost 90.
Wait a minute. You already have mentioned at least two books, maybe three books, that you are wanting to write or in the process of writing.
Yeah.
So clearly, you have plans for the future.
Yes. Whether I'll get there or not is another question, but I think that the experience of becoming 90 is
significant.
Possibly to other people who are in their 80s,
mm-hmm.
and they want to know what it's like to become 90. Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I do it or not is questionable, but what I should do is pick up a tape recorder every day and talk about what happened.
I agree.
Yesterday.
Mm-hmm. You can have a tape recorder like this.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's...
Yesterday, I cracked my hip.
Again.
That's the story.
Right. Again. Right.
Again.
Right. Right. So today, I'm doing isometrics.
Today I'm doing isometrics.
Right. Okay, so I'm just curious. When you were a boy.
When I was a boy.
Yeah, you remember that.
I can't remember that.
Sure you can. Do you remember any interest in theater or stories or acting or influencing
the
world?
Well, I seem to have had an antagonistic personality.
When you were young?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I didn't want to do what the other people wanted to do.
Ah, yes.
So, for instance, when I went to boarding school, Exeter, I brought with me some glass animals.
What was rebellious about that?
Well, it was not done.
To bring little animals? Why not?
It was not done.
What was wrong with it?
I don't know. Ask them. It was the wrong thing to do.
And so that was
and,
that
and then I started to read Karl Marx at whatever it was, 15, 16.
Wow.
Yeah, I was reading Karl Marx. Now, why? I had no idea. I had a history teacher who was very good, and I was reading radical literature.
Right.
And then when I went in the army, I met a radical named Sumner Rosen, who befriended me on the boat back from the war.
Which war?
WW2.
I didn't know you fought in the war.
Yeah. I was there. I was there for 3 years.
My goodness, David.
Right. I was in Germany. Well, I was in Normandy first. And didn't we go through this?
No, oh. I didn't know that. So no wonder you were in your 30s when you first got involved with Paul, because you'd spent the early years in the war.
Yeah.
And then in India.
Right.
And so it sort of took you a little while to find your place.
Yeah, it took a long time.
Right.
But finally, I said, this is what it's going to be. I'm going to revolutionize the cinema. And I did.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
And so, did it with a lot of talented people.
Yeah, but you know what? It strikes me that the revolutionizing of the theater is just another version of bringing the glass animals to Exeter.
I guess so.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, my notion was, let's get rid of the fucking three-act play, because that's not life, that's three acts. And let's get rid of the talky-talky-talky and put in some songs and some poems. And let's do it not in a crystallized theater with 450 seats, but let's do it on the street, which we did. And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It took off.
Yeah. Because it was real. It was immediate.
Yeah, it was close to people walking up and down on their way to work. They look through the glass window and there's Mickey LeGlaire playing chess. And there's the stage with Barbara Harris jumping up and down on it. And it worked. And we got people from the faculty of the University of Chicago and graduates. And some of them were veterans. And I liked that, you know, because I was a veteran too.
Mm-hmm.
So it went. And when it died in Chicago, it came to life in St. Louis and other places.
Yeah. And you've been mining it ever since.
Miming?
No, mine.
Mining it?
Yeah. Digging deeper into it, finding other ways to do it, exploring it.
Well, maybe it mined me. I don't know.
Maybe.
So I'm glad you're not with a videotape camera today because I didn't shave. But I am here.
Yes, you are. You are very definitely here. So, I usually ask, having spent 50 years doing this, do you have something you would want to say about what that's like to dedicate all of these years to this work?
Well, it has nothing to do with making a living. Mm. I made a living in public relations and in advertising.
You did?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I got a job in advertising that paid the rent. So I could be married and have two children.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that 5 days a week, and then I do improvisation on the weekends. A lot of people call me up. I don't know who they are.
Yes.
And they tell me all about their life and whatnot.
And what you and the part you played in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like
and,
I did.
And they thank me for having introduced them to whatever. And
so I'm curious about that. A lot of people call you up. You don't necessarily remember them, like me, really.
Mm.
And they appreciate you and value.
It's nice to have you come back into my life. I find you very sexy.
Oh, gosh. That's lovely. Thank you.
It's all right.
It's
true.
It's very lovely.
Now, where do you want to go?
Well, I think we've probably done it. I mean, I think you have been extremely generous with your time and your memory.
Oh, I don't think I've been generous.
No, what do you think you've
been? If you do, that's fine.
I think we've kind of covered it, David. I'm very grateful.
Now, you want something to eat before you leave? We could cook something up.
Okay, so there you have it. The one-of-a-kind singleton, David Shepherd. Just the most remarkable individual. So very there. And we did cook something up. We cooked up this interview, which I am so grateful to have. And happy birthday, David. And when this runs, it will be 2 days before his 89th birthday. And I want to tell you, in case you are interested in, curious about Life Play, it is still going, and you can participate. I had a long talk with Howard Jerome, who is the face of Life Play at the moment. He's in Ontario, Canada, and he assured me that this is not just only entertainment, although it's terrifically entertaining, but it has so much more to offer. And you can participate by simply calling in. He assured me that while David said you needed to be trained, Howard doesn't think that's true. He thinks that you could play immediately just by hearing it modeled. But if you wanted to be trained, you could call Howard. I'm going to give you Howard's telephone number. I'm going to give you the number of how to call in to play Life Play. And I'm going to do that right now. So Howard Jerome, his telephone number is 416-538-1085. And you call him if you want to get more information or if you want to be trained. Even though he assured me no one really needs to be trained. And if you're willing to just leap in and listen and then participate, on Sunday night at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, you call 712-432-0075, and that's a free conferencing call, so when you hear them answer, you'll have to give them an access code, and that is 574-888, the pound sign. So again, 712-432-0075, access code 574-888, pound sign. And if you had trouble writing this down while I'm speaking it, you can email me at my website, thelynshow.com. Remember, don't leave the E out of Lynn. and I will email you back all of the information. And I am going to play. I may very well play the Sunday after this runs. David is such an extraordinary demonstration of a person who is who he is, has always been who he is. And although he questions why he continues to be who he continues to be who he is. And when you hear David, you know that what you hear is what you get. And of course, that's the intention of the Lynn Show. We can't all be David Shepherd. We can't all revolutionize the theater. But we can all be people who bring little glass animals to their boarding school. We can be people who are ourselves, even when the world doesn't appreciate, understand, embrace it. It's very different than being someone who's always trying to be what the world wants you to be. And of course, you're getting my view of it, but my view of it is that being yourself is dramatically better. And my guess is that if you play Life Play, you will be getting more and more of an opportunity to discover yourself. Perhaps you remember in the interview I was talking about how the thing that David asked me to do during the audition, I remember thinking at the time, this is not something I would normally have done. And yet, of course, it was a part of me. So I want you to find all the parts of you. And you might be able to find some of them in Life Play. So if you call, please tell Howard Jerome hello from Lynn. And who knows, maybe you'll be able to say hello to me directly. Okay, as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go.
Second City.
Yeah,
I performed in Second City, but that's not my show.
Oh, I thought Compass became Second City.
Well, yeah, years later.
Yeah, oh, I see.
It was started by Bernie Sollins, Howard Oak, and Paul Sills. And they invited me to join, but I was at that time in New York, busy producing two children with Suzanne Stern. So I didn't join.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I could have joined, but I didn't.
Ed Asner says the same thing, that he could have, but he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm friends with Ed.
I know.
So.
So then what happened?
Yeah.